Coming up on Weekend America.
Driving out of town this weekend in time for the big holiday? Good news, gas is dirt cheap. But isn't it kind of, I don't know, eerie that gas got so cheap so fast? I'm John Moe. This hour, a look at the curious case of affordable fuel and what it means for our economy. Also, it's the 45th anniversary of JFK's assassination in Dallas, an event that the whole world has been talking about ever since. Well, except in Dallas.
We've taken oral histories starting in the last decade or so from a number of people that had just literally refused to talk about it.
And lots of musicians are inspired by their past, but Dave brings home movies up on stage.
There's a lot of people I think that would prefer not to share their home movies with other people. They wouldn't want people to see them. For me, I've really made the decision to make them more public.
Pass the popcorn and the awkwardness. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Weekends are a big time for getting together with family, right? Special dinner maybe you got planned, a birthday party, trip to the park or the zoo or something. And you know what that means. Video camera, home movies, lots of waving. I always thought that was a little spooky, because who were you waving to? That's right, your future selves. It's like time travel. This hour, we'll meet a musician who harvests those movies and the memories therein for live performances. What are some of your favorite home movie memories?
We did make a home video of my son when he was about 5 months old, balancing before he could walk. We have been paid a couple of times by Japanese television to use the footage.
My brother and my father pulling my young son on a sled down a hill in our backyard.
Well, I took videos of people testing out a deep-sea diving bell.
Gosh, the only home movie that I have is our wedding. And I'm glad I have that because I don't remember much about that day.
Sounds like a very special memory. Those voices came from Portland, Oregon, Collegeville, Minnesota, Birmingham, Alabama, and Norman, Oklahoma, where there's a big football game today. It's been another ungodly ride on Wall Street this week, diving down, swinging up, sliding, then up 494 points again Friday when we heard President-elect Obama's choice for Treasury Secretary. But I've got another number on my mind, $1.73. That was the price of a gallon of gas at a station that I drove by this morning on my way to work. Frankly, I didn't feel that bad about driving into work with prices like that. The price of oil dipped below $50 a barrel this week for the first time in over 3 years. There's speculation it could go as low as $30 before long. But hold on a minute. Not long ago, a gallon of gas was above $4, around $5 in some areas. So what's the deal? Chris Farrell is American Public Media's senior economist, the hardest working man in our company in recent months. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Let's start with gas here. Why so cheap so fast?
There are two reasons. The main reason is just what you started off as the master of understatement. All these wild swings in the market reflecting recession, a global recession. Japan's in recession. We're in recession. People are driving less, and therefore the price of gasoline and the price of oil comes down because we're using it less. But there's another reason.
Uh-oh.
Well, do you remember when the price of oil went up to, what was it, $147?
Yeah, and, way up there.
Way up there. And gasoline, as you mentioned, the national peak was $4.11. Well, there's a speculation going on. That was a bull market speculation. We're now in a bear market speculation. I think there's a lot of people piling in and saying, I never thought it was going to make 50. Now, all of a sudden, we're talking about 40. Maybe it goes down to 40. Maybe it goes down to 30. So part of it's demand, and that's the main reason. But part of it is the speculation of a bear market.
So I'm happy filling up my car at the gas station.
Have you noticed people smile?
They do.
They do.
They
yes.
do. Should I be freaked out about what it could portend?
You know, there's a lot of things to be upset about right now.
Sure.
So if you can fill up your car for less and you can wave to someone you don't know, but he's or she's just smiling at you because it's cheaper, it's fine. Enjoy it. It's going to help out on the budget. However, it's not going down because of conservation or because we found some sort of alternative energy source. It's going down because the economy's weak. So that's the doom and gloom message, which I seem to be imparting an awful lot these days, but that's the doom and gloom message in the lower price.
Yeah, everyone wants to talk to you lately, Chris, but nobody likes you very much. I gotta say. So, well, let's talk about Timothy Geithner then. I do like that his nomination had the power to move the Dow Jones up pretty dramatically just in one day.
Well, we're all saying that, although, you know, who knows why the market goes up at any particular point in time, but it was greeted positively.
Yeah.
Now, the negative side is, and you can say it in, what, three companies, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, AIG. He's involved in all three in terms of the government rescue. Mm. However, he's very competent, has been head of the New York Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, which is really the epicenter of Wall Street in terms of government regulation. And he's deeply respected. And the sense is, and I think this is right, he understands what's going on. He can, what's the cliche, hit the ground running, and he'll make some sort of bold move because he is well aware of what hasn't worked.
What kind of bold move?
Well, I think that everything is shifting toward we need to help out Main Street. We need to help out the homeowner. And that's where the focus. Treasury Secretary Paulson's been resisting this. He says, I don't think I want to do it. My sense is that's the next move, a bold move to help out the homeowner in their mortgage.
Is there such thing as a Geithner doctrine? Is there something that he's going to come in and do right off the bat?
You know, if you look at the Obama appointments on the economic side, you can say the doctrine is centrist, pragmatist, and what I would call a University of Chicago Democrat. They really care about people. They care about things like inequality, but they also believe in markets and innovation.
Hmm. And Chris, this weekend, because economics is no longer a Monday through Friday proposition anymore.
No, absolutely not.
We see you in here on a lot of Saturdays, my friend. What's the buzz in the economic psychodrama this weekend?
Well, the real buzz is about Citigroup, $2 trillion in assets. Its stock has been hammered. It's lost, what, 60% of value in about a week. And there are meetings going on around the world in terms of, will the government offer some sort of lifeline to Citigroup over the weekend so that when the markets open on Monday, we don't have to worry about this situation? There's some sort of solution to the Citigroup lack of confidence.
Chris Farrell is American Public Media's senior economist. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
Forty-five years ago today, President John F. Kennedy and his wife Jackie landed at Love Field Airport, got into the presidential limousine, and emerged onto the streets of Dallas.
Now they're waving, and here comes Jackie waving by, and Mr. Kennedy. Mrs. Kennedy radiant in that pink outfit and the pink hat, and of course you can hear the streets around us.
We all know what happened next, of course. It's been nearly half a century, but interest in the assassination has hardly waned. Every year sees books on the topic, movies, TV specials. The internet provides plenty of theory and purported evidence as well. Americans may be known for their short historical memories. November 22nd, however, seems unlikely to fade from our consciousness anytime soon. But as Weekend America's Julia Barton reports, there is one place where its resonance is oddly muffled. Dallas.
Well, they need to hose this place off again.
Gary Mack and a coworker are taking me through one of the white-painted, fairly useless structures on Dealey Plaza, the city park best known as the place where President Kennedy was shot.
We keep an eye on it, and so do some city people. And sometimes it gets a little run down. I have to make a phone call. Come on, guys, let's get going.
Mack is curator of the sixth-floor museum on the top two floors of the Texas Schoolbook Depository Building. From where we're standing in Dealey Plaza, we can see all the places significant to the assassination. Elm Street, the grassy knoll, the window of the sniper's nest in the Schoolbook Depository.
If you get a chance to go to Dallas, Texas, you must come here. If you've ever heard about the Kennedy assassination, you absolutely have to come here.
I used to come here with my friends in high school when we were bored and driving around downtown. We came here as a joke. In a city with few pedestrians, it was funny to see people walking around, standing and staring. It was funny they were so caught up in the past, stuck in some world that no longer existed. JFK world. That was 20 years ago. JFK world has only grown since then. Larry Hancock lives there, pretty much full time.
we're not really promoting anything. We're simply being critical. That won't help us from being called conspiracy nuts, of course.
2 years ago, Hancock published the 600-page book Someone Would Have Talked. He helps to organize the yearly JFK Lancer November in Dallas conference happening this weekend. It's still going strong, he says. Not so much for sentimental reasons as technological ones. 15 years ago, Congress ordered the government to centralize all records about the assassination. And now with the Internet, anybody can be an investigator.
In 2008, we can do things that they were unable to do and see connections and associations that they had no ability to do back in 1964.
With the web, JFK world has become international. But here in Dallas, it's hard to feel that.
It's been awkward bringing it up, probably more in Texas than anywhere else. And it was a painful. We've taken oral histories starting in the last decade or so from a number of people that had just literally refused to talk about it.
Hancock and the other residents of JFK World want to know everything about Dallas in 1963. All the principal witnesses have been interviewed many times, but others who are just around, in the corners of that time, are starting to tell their stories. Dallas is a place where shame and silence have played a real role, but that's finally starting to change. Almost.
We now join David Daniel, WBAP Newsroom.
The Dallas Police Department today arrested a 24-year-old man, Lee H. Oswald, in connection with the slaying of a Dallas policeman shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated. Oswald was pulled screaming and yelling from the Texas Theater in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas.
Okay, let me flip the lights on over here real fast so we can...
I'm standing with Jason Roberts in the lobby of the Texas Theater. When Oswald ducked in here 45 years ago, the theater was decked out like a Venetian palace with vaulted windows, red and gold walls. After 1963, the theater owners sprayed bright white stucco over everything. A cover-up, you might say. Roberts and the nonprofit he chairs have been trying to get the place restored and reopened for 2 decades. The theater's claim to fame is not much help.
We've talked to several folks in town, and people that remember the time period and have access to some funds that could help. And they were typically the ones that would tell us, just don't talk about Lee Harvey. They just, if you want to do something with it, that's fine, but don't bring in the Oswald portion. And it's hard to kind of educate people and let them know that that's a significant event in history.
We're leaning against the same row of theater seats where Oswald was apprehended. The theater is huge, but it's hot and airless. When Roberts can finally tear out the stucco here and bring this place alive, it'll breathe more oxygen into the city and breathe out a little more shame. And Dallas may finally join JFK World, which is to say, the rest of the world. I'm Julia Barton for Weekend America.
On screen at the Texas Theater tonight, Oliver Stone's film, JFK. It's a fundraiser. There's a free discussion at the 6th floor museum, Living Memory, in which audience members are invited to share their memories of November 22nd, 1963, if they have any and if they are willing to. Photos of the Texas Theater and of Dealey Plaza are at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Lieberman keeps his spot. MySpace is good for kids. Yeah, but what's this about regenerating woolly mammoths? Good news, bad news, no news, and awesome news. Next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Bad news for one astronaut at the International Space Station this week. While on a spacewalk making repairs to the station, she lost a tool bag valued at $100,000. Just lost it. Out it goes into space. Whoops. Of course, not everything in the news fits into such handy categories of bad news, or good news for that matter. Here to break down the terrestrial news of the week into good news, bad news, or no news is our panel, video blogger Jay Smooth. Hi, Jay.
Hello, hello.
And from the political blog Wonkette.com, Sarah Smith. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, John.
Our first topic this week, representatives from the big three automakers were rebuffed in their effort to secure $25 billion in federal bailout funds. No vote was held, but Congress asked Ford, GM, and Chrysler to come up with a plan by December 2nd as to how they'd use the money to avoid bankruptcy, layoffs, and plant closures. Failure of the automaker bailout. Good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I think this is generally good news because it will force the automakers to come up with some of their own ideas about how to restructure. One place where they might start is these executives who took their own private jets into Washington. Anybody who takes a private jet to one of those meetings is so stupid he should not be running a company in the first place. They should all be fired.
Well, I would say I think it should be a good thing, I suppose, that we're asking the CEOs to tell us what they're going to do with the money before we give them all our tax dollars. And I'm in favor of as much public shaming of CEOs as possible in general. But on the other hand, it's hard for me to know what the good side of this would be. And just dealing with this sort of news just makes me feel frightened and alone. So bad news for me.
Next topic. After vigorously campaigning for John McCain for the last several months, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman was in trouble with fellow Democrats. Some wanted to strip his chairmanship of the Homeland Security Committee. Ultimately, after much debate and after President-elect Barack Obama indicated he supported Lieberman, Joe stayed put. Was Lieberman's fate good news, bad news, or no news?
Good for Democrats in the sense that Obama's first news cycle of the transition was not overtaken by some revenge story.
I definitely think it's the wise choice to keep him around. And I think he's like that friend in high school that nobody really wanted to have around, but he was the only kid who had a car. So you sort of tolerated him and enjoyed making fun of him behind his back. I mean, the Democrats, as much as they'd love the catharsis of kicking him out, I think they know it's better to keep his vote around. And, you know, you can stick notes on his back at the congressional lunch table and so on. And I think you can trust that Lieberman is weaselly enough that he's going to know which way the wind is blowing and kind of fall in line and recognize that the conservative era is over and go along with the Democrats from here on in. So I think it's a win-win for everybody.
Right. Yeah. Lieberman has been publicly shamed and reprimanded, even if it wasn't official. I think it was all pretty obvious. And I'm sure he's been kicked out of, you know, the Senate Democratic Chess Club in addition to all of these other grievous punishments.
All right, moving on. Sites like Facebook and MySpace are helpful to teenagers because they help build social skills and internet literacy, as well as teaching managing of a public identity. All this according to a new study by the MacArthur Foundation and not apparently funded by either Facebook or MySpace. Is this finding good news, bad news, or no news? Jay, what do you think?
I think it's good news. I mean, speaking for myself, I grew up in the 80s before we had the web, and I was very shy and socially isolated growing up. And it wasn't until the 90s when I got online and sort of saw that I had this place where I could connect to people with my words. I mean, that gave me a confidence in my ability to connect that carried over into the so-called real world after that.
So you warmed up in the virtual world and then you took the show on the road to real human contact?
To some extent. I mean, if you count instant messaging as real human content, at least.
No, I don't.
Oh, that's terrible. That's so sad.
Sarah, what do you think?
I would say that this is bad news in the sense that, number one, the layout and design of sites like MySpace is just awful. And I think that letting kids spend time polluting their brains and their eyes with those awful, awful design layouts is bad for American aesthetics. Number two, kids are basically illiterate today. And this will not help.
They are?
Yes. You have kids. Aren't they illiterate?
Well, the baby certainly is. We can't get her to read a damn thing.
Lazy, those babies. But no, I feel like every middle school, high school, and even college English teacher I have spoken with in the past 10 years has been like, They can barely form a complete sentence. To actually construct an idea and then support it with examples is completely beyond their reach. And it is because of these dastardly sites like MySpace and Facebook.
I was actually in the library yesterday, and I was there right when all of the high school kids come in to look over MySpace on the free internet there. And, you know, I saw that it's become a part of their regular healthy social ritual that they've always had. And by healthy, I mean extremely loud and full of profanity that gets you kicked out of the library. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, you know, talking about the aesthetics of MySpace. The girl sitting across from me actually at one point looked at a boy's page from their class, and the main girl said, "Oh my God, his page is so ugly. I can't believe I even kissed him." So there is still some value placed on aesthetics out there in some form.
Right.
Good.
He needs to improve his layout skills for him to be my boyfriend.
There's a whole new form of pressure out there in the dating scene now.
Let's move on to the big story of the week. Would you want new woolly mammoths walking around? It was reported this week that for as little as $10 million, that's million automakers with an M, scientists could map the genome and then grow new mammoths, which could then reproduce and repopulate. Would new mammoths be good news, bad news, or no news?
I would venture to say that this would be awesome news.
Please continue.
Well, if we can have massive, ancient, hairy proto-elephants roaming the earth again, then there is hope yet for the Republican Party. And I'm just sad that Michael Crichton is not around to see this new development.
Explain this analogy of yours, Republicans to mammoths.
Oh, well, of course, their mascot is the elephant.
Sure.
And as Republicans seem increasingly devoted to sort of going back and reaffirming their roots and becoming more conservative and doing more of those things that the sort of mainstream America is moving away from, their mascot should not be the modern elephant, but rather the ancient hairy elephant.
I mean, I'm going to say this is no news, because this is what our human species always does, is figure out possibly cool, possibly horrifying things to do. And we've never in the course of human history figured out how to do something and then not done it. So, of course, we're going to do this, and it'll probably go wrong, and we'll go extinct. And then, the question will be, will the super smart cockroaches who replace us decide to bring us back? I think that's where the news is.
You know what? Now that I think about it, maybe that isn't so bad.
Wow.
Maybe.
Nobody will stand up for the humans.
Who will defend the humans when they can't even defend themselves?
All right. Now the news of the week makes sense. Panel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jay Smooth is a video blogger at the hip-hop blog Ill Doctrine. Sarah K. Smith is an associate editor at Wonkette. You can go to our website. You can vote on what kind of news this whole mammoth thing is. You can vote for it being bad news or no news. Although really, honestly, you should vote for it being good news, because it's very exciting. WeekendAmerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Wildfires have caused heavy damage in Southern California. But were some homes saved because of what they grew in their gardens? Ahead on Weekend America. Chinese Democracy comes out tomorrow. And in case you're not a heavy metal fan, that's the new album from Guns N' Roses. Finally. Singer Axl Rose has been writing, rewriting, tweaking, and fussing with this thing since 1994. In other words, he's been editing. Back in their glory days, Guns N' Roses took a completely opposite approach. Don't think about it, just rock. It was brash and raw, and that's how they made classics like Welcome to the Jungle and Paradise City. Which makes you wonder, what would have happened if Axl had worked with an editor back when the band's classic, Sweet Child of Mine, was written? Hi, Axl. Just got your demo for the song Sweet Child of Mine. I think we need to talk. I've recorded my notes here. I know you're not much of a reader. Please make fixes as soon as possible. It seems to me? Why equivocate? You weaken your point by framing this as a personal observation instead of a fact. Reminds me of childhood memories. Redundant. You either have a memory or you're reminded of something. You're not reminded of a memory. Where everything was as fresh as the bright blue sky. Okay, I asked around the office, and no one here is sure a blue sky is fresh. You could have a blue sky at the end of a long, sweaty day, and there would be nothing fresh about it. Fix it. Now and then, when I see a face, she takes me away to that special place. Again, you're weakening your argument. Why does the sight of her face transport you only now and then? But, you know, I see where you're going. The tender Axl, gentle Axl. Not bad. Okay, I get it. Let's move on. And if I stayed too long, I'd probably break down and cry. Yeah, too much. Why would you cry? Heavy metal, Axl. Think heavy metal. Okay, second verse. Axl... eyes can't think of rain. And even if they could, which they can't, why would bluest skies think of rain? You're down the rabbit hole here with this whole imagery thing. I'd hate to look into those eyes and see an ounce of rain. Okay, that's kind of sweet. That's nice. You're still a little drunk on metaphor, but that's good. Oh, delete, fix, do something. You'd hide in a place that reminded you of hair? Never sing such things again. And pray for the thunder and the rain to quietly pass me by. Okay, listen, this is falling apart. Thunder can't quietly do anything. It's thunder. And more importantly, do you really want to come across as this wuss who's constantly on the verge of weeping and skittering into hair caves to escape from rain? Is this a song about love or weather anxiety? You really need to go back to the drawing board on this one. Finally, Axl, we might have had a bit of a misunderstanding regarding my previous notes. When I wrote in colored pencil, "Where do we go now?" I wasn't offering that as a lyric. I was observing that, in narrative terms, the song needed to progress in some way. You love the girl, she's helping you work through some issues, whatever. So, where do we go now? But instead of providing a conclusion, you simply took my note and sang it over and over. Don't ask us, the listeners, where we go. That's up to you as the writer. Tell us where we go now. Again, let's try to fix these things soon, because frankly, if it ever hit the street in its current form, this song would be a colossal failure. Talk soon, your editor. I talked to several Guns N' Roses tribute bands this week. November Rain from Pennsylvania won't be learning songs from Chinese Democracy, nor will Dust and Bones from Minnesota. Hollywood Roses from Hollywood is undecided, as is Boston's Cocaine Tongue. Appetite for Destruction from New Hampshire says they may play part of one song as a joke.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
People are breathing a little easier in Southern California this weekend. The Santa Ana winds died down last Tuesday, and firefighters were able to control the huge blazes that left most of Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, Orange, and Ventura counties shrouded in smoke. Blazes burnt 42,000 acres and destroyed 842 homes in all. After last year's fire in San Diego County left several homes standing in completely burnt-out neighborhoods, researchers figured out that dog and cat doors were letting embers into the house. This year, one of the only surviving houses in a posh Santa Barbara neighborhood may have been spared by the pretty things growing around it. Weekend America's Ben Adair brings us the story.
A secret few Southern Californians will tell you about is how beautiful the fires are. Evacuated homeowners stare in awe as the flames move through the hillsides. They're worried, but also drawn to the flames. The hills behind Santa Barbara are some of the most stunning in the country. Look across and see the light reflecting off trees and green canyons. Beautiful vistas, even with the smoking rubble that used to be a multi-million dollar home. Not even the foundations left. The fires burned that hot.
Because of lack of electricity, the fountains were off, so I came and put these containers, dishes of water, for the birds to come. And when I whistle, the blue jay comes. So I have now definitely have to give him some peanuts because I don't want him to feel like I'm teasing them. There you go. You see, he's coming.
Fred Ashtiani moved here from Virginia to make his garden, and he knows that fires are important to the ecology. A local historian once got into trouble for saying that maybe we should let all the hills burn. Clear out the overdevelopment, along with the dry chaparral and dead trees. Let something new grow.
And there was a huge trunk of a dead pepper tree here, by about 3 to 4 feet wide trunk. And it's just gone and in a huge hole, and all these white ashes.
They're calling last weekend's fire here the Tea Fire. It started with a bonfire that got fanned by the strong winds. 219 homes burned to the ground. To get to Fred Ashtiani's home, take Conejo Road up from Santa Barbara to the burn zone. There's beautiful home, beautiful home, beautiful home, then 2 miles of charred trees and smoldering ash. Red Cross trucks are parked next to BMWs. A rescue worker comforts a woman wearing a diamond necklace holding a Chanel handbag. In front of 498 Conejo Road is a completely burned and melted pickup truck, slouching in the driveway. Fred Ashtiani's there, tending his garden.
I consider myself just as a gardener, you know, and the true owner I consider is a bobcat.
Ashtiani thinks, and some botanists will back him up, that his garden saved his home. Succulents, for example, are full of water and hailed for their flame-resistant characteristics. And there are echeveria, aloes, agaves here. There are also wide brick walkways and small walls, and they probably help too. Some avocado and Persian lemon trees that didn't burn.
My grandfather in Iran was the superintendent of the royal gardens in Tehran, and kings always were in Persian history involved with the gardens, you know, from Cyrus the Great all the way to the last king. They were all happy to show themselves as the lovers of gardens.
The added danger of fire season is that it's followed immediately by the rainy season in Southern California, so these canyons, which were protected, are now at great risk for massive erosion and mudslides. This weekend, Ashtiani is walking the hills around his home and tossing wildflower seeds. His hope is that the plants will grow fast and protect the hillsides. Also, by April, they'll turn the blackened dirt yellow, orange, blue, purple.
Up to this point of my life, I never got sad for a plant that would die because I say, well, you know, every plant has an age, you know, so they die. But this time is a little different, to be honest with you. There is a substantial sadness. But the gardener must move on, and the best thing is to plan, okay, well, how am I going to handle this problem now, you know?
In Santa Barbara, I'm Ben Adair for Weekend America.
Thank you.
We've been doing this series of stories called Garageland about the things Americans like to do in their garages. Garages are places where we tinker, dream, create, hang out. Today's story is about a guy who does all that, plus he goes 150 miles per hour. Weekend America's Sasha Aslanian explains.
Steve Hamill's garage off University Avenue in St. Paul is the Mayo Clinic for vintage motorcycles.
We've got BSAs and Triumphs and Vincents and Velocettes and...
A shelf packed tight with engines runs the length of the garage.
And they're kind of my friends. They sit up there and watch over the shop for me and wait patiently for me to spend some time with them.
People ship Steve vintage engines from all over the country to restore. The garage is crammed with a metal lathe and cabinets of neatly stowed tools. Steve's obsession is his own bike. It's the centerpiece of the garage.
That's a 1950 Vincent, and that bike's gone 155 miles an hour with me on it.
We'll hear what that sounds like in a minute. Steve set a national record in 2006 in the Bonneville Salt Flats of Utah. He broke his hero's record, Rolly Free, set in 1948. Steve reaches for a three-ring binder with a carefully protected black-and-white autographed photograph inside.
There's the picture.
It's a man in a bathing suit lying face down on top of a motorcycle.
So did he take the seat off the bike? Because it looks like he's just lying on the back wheel.
Yep,
so he's got
he
some little rack for his thighs?
Yeah, he's got a little lump of duct tape that he can squeeze with his thighs to keep him on the bike.
Steve doesn't squeeze duct tape with his thighs. Racers nowadays have to sit in seats and wear full leather and helmets. But Steve says motorcycle racing on the salt flats is a very safe hobby.
You got lots of room. It's a good sport for old guys.
Steve is 57.
Your wife she doesn't mind you doing this.
Oh, she's pretty supportive. She's my biggest sponsor and fan.
Have you gone there about how dangerous this hobby could be?
Well, I think she's gonna be okay up to about 200 miles an hour.
I call Steve's wife Wendy Hamill at her office just to check.
As long as all the parts are working, he can go as fast as he wants. But I've never had any feeling of dread, and I don't know why that is. Probably because Steve is so experienced.
Steve does all of his precision mechanics in his garage, but to put the bike through its paces, he can't rely on city streets. He'd get arrested. He loads his bike on the back of his pickup and takes it to his buddies at Silverback Racing in downtown St. Paul. They've got something called a dyno, sort of a treadmill for motorcycles.
I guess it thrills me every time I hear it run.
We're in a small windowless chamber with heavy-duty ventilation fans and two computer screens showing speed and RPMs. Steve hovers near the riderless bike.
Just can't wait to get on again and just wring its neck and let it go.
How would you describe the smell in here now?
Oh, this is a good smell. This is the smell of 110-octane racing fuel. It's quite a wonderful smell. The smell of power and speed.
It sounds a little snaggletooth to me, but when I say that, Steve's face falls. But then the bike warms up and the sound changes dramatically. It becomes smooth and beautiful.
For me, there's a great thrill in riding a machine that I've built and designed. And it's very satisfying to hear it run and listen to all the little mechanical noises, and you know exactly what everything is doing, and you're listening for changes in sound, and as the power rises and as the speed rises, the tone changes and it gets a little angry. It's making a lot of horsepower and the motor is spinning really fast. And as you near, you know, top RPM, you know that your speed is so close to the record, and so you tuck down a little lower and twist the throttle a little harder, even though it's against the stops, and hoping against hope that the thing stays together. And on a good day, you beat your record.
The bike hits 135 miles an hour on the dyno conveyor belt, and our intern flees the room. The power and decibel level in this room are overwhelming. My teeth are rattling. Steve grins. It's back to the garage for him. He's got a lot of work to do. His dream is to get the Vincent up to 200 miles an hour. In St. Paul, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Weekend America.
You can see a video of Steve's Vincent motorcycle on the dyno and see images of Steve Hamill and Rolly Free setting records in Bonneville. That's at weekendamerica.org. If you're in the Great Lakes area of the country, it's a weekend for lake effect snow. In the south, it's a weekend of very chilly mornings, but sunshine throughout the day. And according to Weekend America's Jeannie Yandel, it's also a weekend of ducks and dickens.
The holiday season can seem to stretch on forever. Norfolk, Virginia is getting it all over with during the Grand Illumination Parade. They're celebrating Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Christmas, and New Year's all in one day. 35 and cloudy for holiday-themed light designs, lighted floats, and light-decorated cars. Afterwards, the entire city of Norfolk will be dark until April. When Charles Dickens was a kid, he worked 10-hour days in a shoe polish factory. Probably that won't be featured in Cambridge, Ohio's Dickens Victorian Village, but you can meet characters from Dickens' best-known stories. Sonny and 37 to avoid orphaned pickpockets, encounter crazy old women in wedding dresses, and cower before angry ghosts. Wow, there better be some wassail at the end of all that. Imagine hearing someone calling your name over and over and over for hours. Now you have a sense of what ducks in Stuttgart, Arkansas go through during the World Champion Duck Calling Contest. 53 and Sunny for duck calling competitions and ducks slowly being driven insane. The event culminates with every duck in Stuttgart yelling, "What? What do you want?" For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Coming to grips with who you were as a kid is an important part of growing up. And for one Seattle rock band, it's an important part of a live show. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The Seattle band Head Like a Kite, led by musician Dave Ionmoe, is playing a free show at Newmo's in Seattle tonight. Dave's family will be at the show. Kind of. For the last few years, Dave has been rummaging in his parents' home for the videos that he remembers from being a kid and sampling the sounds from those videos for his music. When he performs, he often has a projector with family films showing behind his band. Dave explains why his family home movies are worth sharing with strangers.
The sound of the projector, I grew up to that sound. Every Christmas, every, you know, birthday, whenever we would go on vacation, when we would come back, we would watch our home movies. And so to me, that warm sound of the film going through the projector and the reels turning was, I don't know, really soothing and brings back a lot of memories for me. There's a lot of people I think that would prefer not to share their home movies with other people. They wouldn't want people to see them. But for me, I've really made the decision to make them more public for a lot of reasons. One is the inspiration that they've given me for creating these songs. But then in addition to that, I think the visuals, that when people see them, they really react to them live. And that's been really exciting for me. There's a lot of clips in these films of the Statue of Liberty, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, Disney World, really iconic figures that people recognize, and they really respond to that. I think the one that makes me smile the most when I hear it is my mom trying to turn off the camera. My mom had a lot of challenges with technology, and she continues to have those challenges.
Happy birthday to you.
Gee, that was nice.
Hey, just a minute. The thing keeps going even when you're not pressing it. Wait a minute. How do you stop it?
What you're seeing on the screen is my dad sitting on the couch, and then suddenly the camera switching to the floor and switching to the ceiling and switching to the walls and switching to a dog. And it's hilarious just watching this thing shake, 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 and finally it just goes to black. My dad was perfect with film. He didn't shake it at all, which is pretty funny considering my mom's problems with technology. Now, his shots were always straight on, and he was always really into the panoramic view where he would start on one thing and then slowly move over to the left. So sometimes my dad would zoom in on me, and it's pretty funny to watch that because I would always make these sort of silly, awkward faces where I obviously didn't want my dad to do it, so I would sort of run or hide. He did this great thing of capturing all of these films, and I think part of it might have been inspired when he grew up, you know, during the World War II and seeing all of the World War II footage coming back when he would go to the movies. Because even the way he talks and the way he narrates seems very inspired from that era.
The photo you see here shows the circle of life, which was a theme of the entire park. Man and woman, how they must get along with each other. Notice the circle has no beginning and no end.
The first time my parents ever saw us was when we were on tour. My dad and my mom knew that we were using films live. We were using their films. For me, it's really a warm feeling to have my family be part of Head Like a Kite Live. A great example is actually this song. We played it in San Francisco, and there was a couple there from Norway that came to see us. And as we were playing this song, they were watching it and really got excited when they saw the images from a park that from the same city that they were from.
The park of life, of no beginning and no ending.
My dad is filming the different sculptures through this park in Oslo. And it's classic 70s clothing, you know, big bell bottoms and just outrageous jackets and huge hair and amazing amount of mustaches. And it was impressive to see. I mean, it was like Starsky and Hutch in Oslo. It was really cool. A lot of times I'm so lost in the music that I forget what's going on behind me visually. And I'll see people suddenly start to laugh, and I'll think, well, what are they laughing at? And then I realize, well, clearly they're laughing because my sister has just fallen off of a float in Disneyland or something. There's a certain group of people that just stare at the screen. They're just almost hypnotized by it. And then there's another group of people that are just dancing and just going nuts, you know, just really partying. And to be honest, I kind of struggle with that because The music live that I like to play is much more of the dance party vibe, but I really want to be able to incorporate the film, so I need to figure out a way to keep the films, but at the same time, you know, make it so that people can cut loose and not feel like they have to be hypnotized by it. It's funny because some of these scenes kind of become so much a history of my life that I think I take that a little bit for granted, that I've got it documented and I can watch it, so that if I didn't really remember it the way it happened, I can go back and remind myself what really did happen.
Dave Ayenmo and his band Head Like a Kite are at Numo's in Seattle tonight. Their music video is online right now at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Larissa Anderson, who joins us this week as our new poetry producer. Expect stanzas, quatrains, possibly a limerick in the future. Sasha Aslanian, who's attempting both an early Thanksgiving and a Calexico concert this weekend. Julia Barton, who'd settle for finding time for a haircut this weekend. Rob Byers, Hillary Frank, Michael May, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitsch, Angela Kim, who is on week 3 of her birthday celebration, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Week. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. Don't forget to become a fan on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/theweekend. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America, inviting you to bust out of that Monday through Friday rut and take an adventure with us. Each weekend, we go all across America and to places beyond, places like Dubai.
It's kind of crazy when you can come over to the desert and ski in the middle of a mall.
Escape your work week routine. Spend part of your weekend with us on Weekend America.